You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, February 11th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Monday evening.
Yeah, it's a rare Monday recording, but we are going to the AAAS on Saturday to do a live podcast at their meeting, so we have to get this week's show out of the way. How are you guys doing on this Monday? You guys all love Mondays, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I kind of like Mondays. Mondays for me are like extended weekends, because my first real work day is Tuesday.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Works for you.
You know what tomorrow is, February 12th.
Tomorrow's a snow day in Connecticut.
Probably, yeah. Darwin's birthday.
Hey, Darwin, 210.
Wow, he is old.
Darwin's 210.
Now, what's he doing for work these days?
Right? That's
awesome. He'll be at the AAAS conference.
He's being the patriarch of evolutionary biology.
Yeah, but what's he done for us lately?
Yeah, it's not like his ideas have held up all these years, have they?
Yeah, did you guys hear that Michael Behe came out with a new book?
No.
Oh my gosh. Michael Behe. We haven't talked about him in a while.
Yeah. Okay, tell me who this person is. Catch me up. New
Darwin's
skeptic here.
Black Box, Irreducible Complexity.
I know
that ringing a bell.
Yeah, it is, for sure.
Yeah.
So
what's
basically,
the new book?
Basically try to throw a scientific patina on
creationism.
Yeah, creationism, essentially, yeah.
And it doesn't help that he's an actual biochemist with, like, degrees.
Well, it doesn't help much. It doesn't help his cause either. It doesn't hurt.
No, but it definitely confuses some people, some members of the public, for sure.
Sure.
So his new book is Darwin Devolving, and it's just as nonsensical as his previous two. So it looks like his main thesis is that because a mutation which degrades a gene can theoretically lead to an increase in the number of offspring, then evolution can really be devolution.
Degrades?
Degrade, right. There's no such thing as degrading a gene.
Right, that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I was going to say, even if that existed, how common would it be?
But he basically is denying that mutations can be like a creative, constructive effect.
Or how?
I know, because... And then he gets criticized.
It hurts. The stupid hurts.
I mean, it was so bad that actually Science published a response.
Yeah, they
fantastic.
Did.
Fantastic.
Good. Standing up to him.
Yeah. The first author is Lenski. You guys remember Lenski?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah.
With the bacteria, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically saying, no, here's like all sorts of examples of gene, we have really rock solid evidence for gene duplication as a mechanism of creativity in the evolutionary process. You know, like you could see where the genes were, how they divided and split off over time. You know, like this gene's related to that other gene. There must have been a gene duplication event at some point in time.
Right.
And there's multiple examples. And Behe just ignores them, ignores the counter examples. Then he crows like, oh, they couldn't counter anything I had to say in my book. They crushed everything.
Oh my gosh.
You're just delusional at that point.
Did Lenski talk in the response about his bacteria study? Which has been ongoing since, I just looked it up, 1988. So like multiple November 2016, 66,000 generations. And just watching evolution before our eyes.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
You could even do it programmatically now and show the rise of complexity and adapt and everything. All the hallmarks of evolution you could see in a computer now. You could see it in 10 minutes. You don't even have to wait weeks or months or years for some of these fast reproducing microbes to show it to you. It's ridiculous. So I think we should thank Science Magazine. How could we thank them? Let's go talk for them soon.
Yeah, let's maybe we should go podcast at AAAS and
It's a great example of just someone being able to completely blind themselves to legitimate information and stay within their paradigm and, stay within that bubble that they create around themselves. It's scary because we're so good at it.
Mm-hmm. We are excellent at it. We've all seen amazing examples of it. It's pathological thinking, and it's really – it just shows you what – you go down the rabbit hole of an ideology and what it can do to your thinking. It's really remarkable.
But we all do it every day. We do it every day. Like if you – Reddit is a really good –
they're experts.
Yeah, that's the difference, right, Jay? Like, it's one thing for us to make these cognitive errors and to, like, keep ourselves within these bubbles of safety and security or maybe convenience. It's another thing for somebody to be an active, quote-unquote, educator within these areas. And
his career is one giant cognitive error.
Yeah, but he's drawing other people into it. That's the frustrating part. And there's a patina, there's a sheen of legitimacy around it because he's a biochemist, because he knows all the words, right? Because he publishes all these books. It's frustrating.
Oh, yeah. He's championed by the creationism world out there, definitely.
And people cite him.
Yeah, well, he provides them cover, basically. But think about it, though. 20 years ago, he comes out with Darwin's Black Box. He's trying to make intelligent design scientific, and it gets thoroughly trashed by actual scientists who know what they're talking about. The scientific community responded by either ignoring him or ridiculing him, essentially. His career as an his reputation goes down in flames, and he's had to live with that for the rest of his career. And now he's just sniping
doubling
from the sidelines,
and tripling
going,
down,
yeah,
too.
That's basically what his career has been reduced to.
Yeah, but he doesn't view it that way.
I know, but that's why he has to. My point is that that's how bad it is. He has to be thoroughly delusional because that's the only thing he's got left.
Yeah, he's like, but I'm a champion of these new counter thinkers, and mainstream science doesn't accept me and my views that are outside of the accepted dogma of science,
my
which is hilarious.
Ignoring of
history will vindicate
published
me.
Evidence. Yeah,
which is
history
so funny because he's just recapitulating the actual dogma that science pushed.
That is
back
the
against.
Calling card of every crank in history.
Yeah, he's a crank. He's absolutely a crank. All right, we did our duty for Darwin Day.
Yeah. You said
happy
duty.
Happy birthday, Charles.
Duty. So speaking of debunking pseudoscience, Bob, you have a very interesting forgotten superhero of science this week.
Yes, this week I'm going to talk about four forgotten superheroes of science. Alice Lee, 1858 to 1939, who was an English mathematician and statistician, and was among the first scientific debunkers of myths equating skull size with intelligence. Lee studied at Bedford College from 1876 to 1884. Later, she was among the first women to graduate from the University of London. And she got her PhD in 1901, which is amazing if you think about it. 1901, when I saw that date, I was like, wow. Just an amazing accomplishment, just barely into the 20th century. Amazing. So during this time, she became fascinated with using the application of statistical methods to evolutionary biology. And I love this hopefully non-apocryphal story about her from the Smithsonian.com, which tells the story of Lee in June 1898 marching into the all-male Anatomical Society meeting at Trinity College in Dublin. And she pulled out a measuring instrument using their own instruments against them, which was fantastic. She then began, it says, to take stock of all 35 of the consenting society members' heads. Lee ranked their skulls from largest to smallest to find that, lo and behold, some of the most well-regarded intellects in their field turned out to possess rather small, unremarkable skulls. Mm. So what a dramatic presentation. Because it was, that belief was rife at this time that the bigger your skull, therefore the bigger your brain, and therefore the smarter you were. And of course, since men generally are bigger than women, they are clearly must be smarter. She was directly tackling that head on, so to speak. Lee's study proved to be the most sophisticated criticism of cranium science to date at that time. And then within 10 years of publishing her findings, measuring crania, if that really is the plural, to determine smarts was basically extinct. I mean, nobody was really doing it. So remember Alice Lee. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing superior frontal gyri, supraorbital ridges, or even perhaps parietal eminences.
This is the first time you've done one of these where you use that babble, and I understood what all those words meant.
Yes. These are not super crazy obscure. I like throwing in supraorbital ridges because that is actually a marker of used to distinguish male from female, which is kind of ironic that I use that. So check her out, Alice Lee.
So, Baba, everything you said is correct, but ironically, this is somebody who, she's more complicated because she was on the correct side of history when it comes to using craniometry to debunk the inherent superiority of men over women. But she got it wrong when it came to race, because she actually upheld the arguments for biological differences between definable races using the same tools of biometry and craniometry. So she got, using the same kind of ideas and same background, she was correct when it came to the sexes, but wrong when it came to the races. And she basically was a eugenicist at the end of the day.
Yeah, this is one of the risks when you're researching somebody that goes back, you know, well more than, you know, farther than a century.
Yeah.
That's so far in the past, and there were so many, you know, like pre-scientific, you know, or early scientific beliefs then about various things. So yeah, that definitely can happen and has happened in the past for sure.
Yeah, and it also brings up the point that you kind of have to judge people by their own time. It's easy to look back 100 years later and say, yep, she totally got that wrong. That was clearly just, she fell victim to the racial biases of her time and place. No question. But so did a lot of people at that time.
Sure.
Well, and let's be clear, like, she worked in Carl Pearson's lab. Carl Pearson, mm-hmm. you know, one of the original biostatisticians of the intelligence movement of developing IQ, was a massive eugenicist. So there was a lot of, you know, within the intelligence kind of early psychology community, the statistical community, and obviously this, what did they call it? Craniometry? Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. They all coalesced. And the fact that she was working directly with Pearson, he was like one of the architects. So that's not, you know, obviously that doesn't excuse it by any stretch. It was a dominant paradigm at the time in academics, but she was surrounded by eugenicists. And actually, it seems like for her, it was an alternative, right? Because these people also, Pearson, Galton, all these people also really argued for the inferiority of women based on all these traits as well. So she was pushing back against that, probably was giving in on race in an effort to stay in those circles,
mm-hmm.
which is tough. You know, it was a really tough time to be a woman. And I mean, a woman scientist.
So she's a flawed hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we have imperfect hero.
We have to acknowledge that, though.
Most of them are.
We learn about Pearson. We learn about Galton. These were architects of psychology, but come on. Like, they had some real problems. Like, massive. Sure. They set things back as much as they brought certain things forward.
Yeah, like, you have to remember, like, Abraham Lincoln was a total racist by modern standards.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
All right, let's go on with some news items. You guys are familiar with the trolley dilemma, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Classic.
It's not so much a dilemma.
I think we're going to talk about some robots right now.
Well, there's a dilemma.
It's a dilemma for sure. It's like a basic ethics question.
I'm still all torn up about it.
Yeah, exactly.
it's a great paradigm because you could make so many versions of it. And I'm bringing up now because of a recent paper where they substituted robots for some of the people in the dilemma. So the basic setup is this. It doesn't have to literally be a trolley, but that comes from the original study where they gave people a choice. Okay, you're in a trolley that's the brakes are broken and it's out of control. Yep. Going down the track, there's five people on the track that you're going to run over and kill. Mm-hmm. You have one moment to switch to a different track where there's only one person. Would you switch tracks to save five people but kill one? And most people do the math and say, yeah, one person's less than five. You got to kill somebody. Go for the thinner crowd.
But the question is that they are actively killing that one, whereas they're passively killing five. That's where the dilemma comes in, right?
Well, no, but there's a different levels of involvement. So mm-hmm. One of the classic way to vary it is say, okay, now let's say same exact situation, but you don't have the ability to switch tracks. But standing in front of you at the front of the trolley is an exceptionally large person. And again, you have to sort of buy the premise. Don't challenge the premise. If you push them off the front of the trolley, they will get stuck under the wheels and stop it and save the five people. But they're definitely going to die in the process.
And you're actually pushing them.
Yes,
you're pushing a button.
Actively killing somebody.
Yeah.
So most people would not do that. So while most people will pull a lever and switch tracks, most people will not push somebody off the trolley to kill them. So
interesting.
Yeah, so that's what's interesting about it is that it's our moral calculus is not entirely utilitarian or deontological, meaning that it's not just about a principle. It's not just about an outcome. It's about something else. You know, it's in this case, how we feel. Mm-hmm. You know, we feel more responsible when we take the more direct action or more proximate we are to the cause of death. The less direct it is, the more we, you know, our calculus will differ. So, and what's wonderful about this paradigm is you could say, okay, what if there's two people versus five? Does the number matter? Or what if you have five old people walking across the tracks and there's a 10-year-old schoolgirl on the other track? Are you going to kill that 10-year-old schoolgirl to save the life of five, you know, geriatrics?
Yeah, what if the guy just lost 50 pounds and he's really excited about it?
But people do think that younger people's lives are worth more than older people's lives.
It's a great window into values. All this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or what's great about this dilemma is that you could tweak it, make little changes, and see how it impacts the end result.
So, Steve,
like with robots.
Is the takeaway from this to harden yourself to be able to make these hard decisions?
It's just a way of understanding the algorithms in our brains that we use to make gut-feeling moral choices. Like, what if that one person was, you know, Fred from accounting? You know them, sort of. You know, does knowledge of the person, would you save them over five strangers? You know, does your knowledge of somebody increase their relative value? Well, that turns out.
Well, it massively does. For most people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, because you've taken them in sort of as your group, your company, your tribe, whatever you want to call it.
Well, yeah. So that, Evan, you get to the next layer, right? We could describe what people do statistically, you know, how their decisions are affected. But then we want to, you know, psychologists want to try to understand why people feel that way. What is the process, the mental process? And what the consensus, and this is always an evolving kind of answer because psychology is really hard in this way, especially when you're trying to infer down to root causes. The current idea is that if we can relate to how somebody else feels, you know, we can sort of relate it to how we feel, then we will sympathize and empathize with them more. We will not see them as a stranger or a robot, right? As an automaton.
Sure.
Right. So if someone's acting in a way that I can understand by extrapolating from my own feelings, then I assume they feel the same way that I do, and therefore we're less willing to hurt them or kill them. Enter the robots, right? So now we do the trolley problem. Woo-hoo! But it's not.
Send in the robots.
But yeah, the dilemma is crafted so that the situation calls upon the person to sacrifice a robot to save people.
Is it a sentient robot?
Well, that's the question. So these are the variables. So there are the robot. Well, first of all, they did the dilemma, the moral dilemma setup. And the person that you had to sacrifice was either a human being or a robot that looks like a person, but it's clearly a robot, but you know, it's like a humaniform robot, or a robot looking robot, you know, doesn't look like a person.
Mm-hmm.
So does that matter, right? So would we, you know, what percentage of people would not sacrifice the person, would not sacrifice the human looking robot, would not sacrifice the robot looking robot? And as predicted, more people would save the person than the human-looking robot, but more people would would not sacrifice the human-looking robot than the robot-looking robot. So how human it looks, even though they know that it's a robot, how human it looks affected their decision-making about whether or not they would be willing to sacrifice it.
Wait, are they sacrificing it to save other robots or
to save people? Always
that's
to save people.
That's effed up.
That, tell me about it.
That's so effed up.
Not sacrifice a robot to save people.
What? Just because it has cute eyes?
Right.
That's nutter butter.
Hang on. So then they also primed the trials with a story about the robot. You know, and in one case it was neutral, meaning it didn't imply anything about the nature of the robot. But in another version, another group of subjects, they told a story about the robot that they would have to sacrifice that implied that the robot had sentience. And so if they thought that the robot had feelings, they were more likely to not sacrifice it.
So they gave the robot a backstory, and that got people all.
Well, but also that the robot could feel. That's very different, right?
Well, So then they did a follow-up study where they wanted to tease that apart a little bit more, where the priming. So they had the neutral priming, and then the priming that was designed to make you feel like, you know, the robot had a positive attribute, and they split that up into, and this is really the new bit here in this study, into agency, like a story that indicates that the robot has agency, or a story that indicates that the robot has feelings.
Yeah, it's the emotions that are going to get people.
Yes,
right?
And that's what it was. And so again. In every condition, the people were less willing to sacrifice the robot. So whether it looked more human or if it had agency, but it was especially so if it had what they called affective traits, or essentially it feels the way I feel. Therefore, I make a bond with it. And people were not willing, significantly so, were not willing to sacrifice the robot that had any kind of affective trait.
So some people chose to run over the five humans rather than destroy the one robot.
Yeah.
A fair amount of people, apparently. Enough that there was a statistical difference there.
That's an interesting blur of conscious thought there. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think the idea here is like, because my question would be, and I guess it wasn't primed, is can we just make a new robot? But it's true. Once you introduce this layer of it can feel pain.
No, it's not necessarily that it would suffer. It was just that it has...
an emotional life,
That it
it's self-aware.
That would involve emotional suffering.
Life. Emotionally,
it not necessarily even self-aware. Just that it could, mimic emotions.
Yeah, but that to me that means that it can feel pain, and that's really what it comes down to for me, at least personally. I don't want to hurt it. I don't want to hurt it emotionally or physically.
Ah, interesting. But for me, it's the awareness question.
Me too.
Really? Why?
Yeah, but this had nothing to do with whether or not, the robot's not a self-aware sentient being in any part of the study. It's just acting with agency or had different affective states or feelings.
I understand.
Why would you care if it had, if it was self-aware, except for the fact that it can have feelings, which is really the core of it?
Yeah.
Well, because I think for me personally, that crosses a line.
No, but
that's just my thought.
No, I get it, but doesn't it imply, isn't the reason it crosses the line because the robot can feel?
I think you need awareness before even feeling, right?
So you're saying if it was aware but couldn't feel, you still wouldn't want to kill it?
Well, I think if it's aware, it can feel. I think that's a given.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's it's one and the same for all intents and purposes for the study. Right. Yeah. I think
so.
That's,
we're splitting hairs here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think so. Like, obviously, they're two different things generally, but I think for the purposes of a person having an empathic connection with the robot, it comes down to the fact that they can feel. I think it's the same reason, Steve, that we like furry pets that make eye contact versus fish. Like, we don't care if our fish die, we don't cry over it. Mm-hmm. I mean, young kids.
I agree. I've cried over fish.
That's adorable.
Yeah, Jay cries. Jay cries whenever he finishes his box of Swedish fish
or spills milk.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, anything that we feel that we're sharing emotions with, sharing moments with, we're going to assign it agency, whether it has a consciousness or not.
Look, if my daughter, when she was growing up, at 4 years old, had a favorite stuffed toy and she witnessed something terrible happen to that stuffed toy, I know she would be horribly upset by that.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. Because she sees it as, having that empathic
connection. They attribute essence to inanimate objects, especially a favorite inanimate object, some kind of unique essence. This is more about, this is agency versus affective states. So this has implications which I think, on multiple layers, right? So from one point of view, we need to be aware of our hardwiring. This is the human condition. And because, it's in a way, people are kind of easy to manipulate emotionally and socially. And being aware of how easy it is to be manipulated can is protective in a lot of ways.
That's what social psychologists are really good at. That's why they're amazing at advertising.
Oh, boy.
Right. Like advertising is basically an entire industry, the purpose of which is to manipulate your decision making. So, but if you have like a well thought out ethical philosophy ahead of time, you can get on top of that, right? Make decisions that are good rather than just gut reactions, which may not be really adapted to the situation. We obviously didn't evolve to deal with robots, you know?
That's true.
So I think I'm ready for it, Steve.
Yeah, you might be ready for it, but I'm saying your hardwiring is not adapted to a world of robots. So you may react to them in a way that is not optimal.
Well, do you think that you could love a robot?
Well, that's the point, right?
No, I'm asking you.
I think you can have feelings towards an inanimate object that has, again, that checks those boxes, right? If it's acting with agency and affective states, your brain will absolutely.
Steve, would you marry a robot?
No, Steve probably wouldn't marry a robot. He's already married. But no, it's true, Jay. Like, that's why that movie Her was really effective for a lot of people. And like, that's why, or Ex Machina or whatever, you know, fill in the blank. Yep. We evolved as a social species. Like, it's so deep in our brains. Like social cues. We just can't ignore them. We see faces everywhere. We feel emotional pulls to things that are inanimate simply because they provide us with a sense of, you know, connectedness. Even if you ignore all the neuroscience and you just look at like the psychology kind of philosophy literature, you know, my kind of area, existential psychology, they believe that one of the core reasons that people go to therapy is because of a concept known as loneliness.
Yeah.
Like, we desperately need interpersonal connection. Even Bobby Fischer, remember, he was like, he had some issues and he didn't really like to be near people and he had a lot of social problems. I'm not sure if he was, you know, on the autism spectrum or if he was more dealing with some psychosis or some combination thereof. But even when he died on his deathbed, didn't he have some famous quote about how the human touch is the most healing of all?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
it's so important.
I don't recall that quote,
but totally.
But Steve, isn't this scenario also measuring basically the difference between humanity early on, say 50 or 100,000 years ago, and what modern culture has done? So I think if you did this test, you know, say 50,000 years ago, I think our responses would be more, you know, there'd be more knee-jerk reactions and less of the considered reactions, right? Because you alluded to the fact that there's two, you could have two reactions. One is your gut feeling, but you could also have a reaction that you've pondered and thought about.
I don't think the instincts are going away. I think we're just layering on top of that the philosophical reaction.
Right. My point is the considered reaction is becoming increasingly divergent as you'd like
to think so.
Yeah. Well,
we want
it
to be.
Well, I absolutely think so. I mean, if you did this test, 30,000 years ago, I think you'd see interesting differences. Of course, you'd have to, you know, you wouldn't have a trolley car. You'd have some sort of Flintstone car.
Flintstone.
The authors make the specific point, which I thought was interesting, that we have to take this into consideration when we design our robots. That you don't, like, if you're making a robot whose job it is to retrieve bombs, you don't want to make it too cute, because then people will be reluctant to allow it to blow itself up. So any robots that necessarily will be put into danger or would need to be in a situation they would be sacrificed to save people, you don't want the operators hesitating because they have an emotional attachment to the robot.
Well, and the funny thing is that robots in industry, we first started to develop them to look humanoid so that we could work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, side by side, if I'm a factory worker and then there's a robot doing something next in line, I want to be able to empathize with it so that I don't, you know, get frustrated by it, so that I am not afraid of it, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. So it's heading in that direction of more human-like robots, in fact, you know, fully mimicking facial expressions with no self-awareness or actual affective states, but fully mimicking affective states and agency. And we psychologically totally buy it.
Well, look at the Furby.
There's a downside to that.
Yeah.
I would think there would be downsides.
The downside is that we may actually make bad decisions when deciding who to sacrifice or, you know, or who's in danger, or should I run to that burning building?
Yeah. And conversely, if the robots that are actually sapient slash sentient, you probably want to make them a little bit cuter because these are actually, you know, emotional thinking beings.
So that
presumably.
It made me think, though, Bob, about the typical science fiction trope of the robot uprising, where a almost ubiquitous component of that is that humans treat robots like shit.
And right.
That would not necessarily be the case. This suggests that, we would treat them like people.
Well, but they could still treat them like shit. I think that a common trope is they treat them like they're a race of people, that they are. Yeah, but there's a link there, right, between objectifying outgroup races and historical disenfranchisement. So I think that's where the trope comes in. It's very District 9, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Subhuman, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Right, robots would have to be treated like a subhuman class.
Yeah.
Even though we recognize their humanity.
Well, but there's a big problem with that.
Yeah.
Because if they truly are artificially intelligent and they're in the spectrum, you know, and of course there's a million gray areas here, but if they're in a human-like spectrum, man, we are setting ourselves up for big, big social mistakes and who knows what.
What do you mean?
Meaning that we have to treat all life with respect, even if it's –
but they're not alive.
Wait. I know, but this is the gray area because, there's going to probably be a time when we're creating – artificial intelligences that we're not sure if they're conscious or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are we going to do? We're going to test them and see, walk like a duck, talk like a duck, the whole deal. Like, how complicated will our testing get before we're like, hey, you know what? These things are pretty much conscious. That, we don't.
They'll cross that boundary at some point.
Yeah, but that's
how will we know is Jay's question.
Well, we'll know because our society will effectively decide that it's time to. Well, to make that decision.
We won't know. We'll just decide.
And we'll probably be late to the party.
We'll make an arbitrary decision at a certain point.
Yeah, but knowing us, we'll be really late to the party. And there will always be some bleeding edge activists that people actually denigrate who see it before everybody else.
Sure, and there's going to be contingents of lawyers who are going to be fighting like crazy to get these things recognized as sentient beings with rights and all sorts of things. I mean, there's a whole industry there.
Yeah, but we see it with great apes and it hasn't really caught on and they are alive. So I don't know if I would put this much faith in our humanity.
But we're moving in the right direction in terms of laws to protect primates, in research, for example, and great apes. And you're right that works both ways. We can humanize things even prematurely, but we could also dehumanize groups of people. Like the Nazis did to the Jews. They literally dehumanized them to the point that they had no value. You pretty much have to see somebody as subhuman or not human.
That's common.
To treat
them. Common in war. That's very common.
Yeah, I know.
It's also common in.
It's too easy.
It's also common in xenophobia. I mean, we see it even with debates about immigration. There's all sorts of words that are flung around to dehumanize, the quote other to help maintain some sort of, worldview about them. And it's terrible because, Genocide Watch puts it as an early precursor to genocide.
Mm.
So you have to be careful about that kind of stuff. It's something that we do even in interpersonal stuff. Even a one-on-one fight with somebody else will dehumanize them to invalidate their views.
Right.
Those damn synths. You Schweinhund. Pig dog.
Yeah.
No, it's like the synths in Fallout 4, right, Jay?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you bring that up, Steve, because it did cross my mind during this conversation. I mean, I'm playing a video game where they've created these synths, and then there's advanced synths who really seem like they have real personalities and a real mind in there. And, I don't know. I mean, I really –
that's the question.
I don't know. But I'm just telling you from my I'm the guy playing the game. Like, I'm not even talking about the character I'm playing in the game. I'm talking about me sitting at my desk playing this video game. It's funny. The synth and the dog are the two characters in Fallout 4 that I got the closest to emotionally as the player, as me. It's a whole other discussion to get into, but it's such an interesting thing to talk about, though. Think about it.
Hey, Jay, did you see the episode of Black Mirror? I think it was not in this past season, but the one before, where the war children, basically, I shouldn't say children, young adults were fighting a war, had the implants, or they wore those like VR things that made the enemy look like an insect.
Yeah.
No, I didn't
remember
see that.
That? That's
great
exactly
idea.
What we're talking about. And then some of them kind of got hip to the fact, because they were glitching, that they were real people and it really effed them up.
Yeah, that's
exactly what we're talking about. Like making a war machine to actually dehumanize a person, which we've always done historically through language and propaganda and things like that, but actually to do it at a kind of physiological or virtual reality level would be incredibly effective and horrifically scary, which of course is why Black Mirror featured it so well.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, I know. And bringing up virtual reality, it's a good point to end on, because you know the researchers and others point out that you know this research is essentially online. And you wonder if there's an artifact to that and if people would behave differently in a real world situation. But virtual reality is so much more immersive. And I think psychologists are really moving towards doing virtual reality based research, because you could do this sort of thing, Jane. It's like playing a great video game, but in virtual reality, right? So it might give us much more realistic responses and better data. Than doing it just on a screen or whatever.
Yep.
Right? Could you imagine doing virtual reality psychology research where like you're actually on a trolley? You know what I mean?
You're entering Westworld or something.
Well, that would be so fascinating.
Yeah,
though,
Ted Danson's driving.
Ted Danson.
All right, Jay, tell me about this concrete battery.
There is a Swiss company called Energy Vault, and they've come up with this really novel idea that can store potential energy. Now get this, they're using these concrete batteries, like Steve said, but you know, when we say concrete battery, we mean that they're using concrete blocks, and these blocks are used to store potential kinetic energy. So what everybody wants to know. I've got 12 phone calls just today about this. So to explain it, Kara.
Yep.
So you're carrying a bowling ball up a flight of stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're going to go up 10 flights of stairs from the ground. Each step that you take increases the bowling ball's potential energy, right? So the higher
Because it wants to roll back down.
Right. It wants to go down. So the higher you bring it, the more potential energy it has, right? So everything that's been lifted up into the air has potential energy. So now imagine a tower that's built out of modular concrete blocks. Now let's say that we have we have excess energy, right? So it's during the day, sun is cranked, we have a solar array, and we have a lot of extra energy, and we don't know what to do with it. So what we could do is we could take that extra energy and lift up these concrete blocks and slowly build a round tower or concentric circles of a tower using a series of 6 cranes. So the cranes will displace and connect these concrete blocks together. And if you see the cool video that they made, they kind of connect together like not like Lego pieces, but they have like these things that slide so they lock so the thing just can't topple over.
Like Lincoln locks.
Okay.
Now, so the entire tower is built this way. So the tower like probably just has a foundation when there's no energy stored in it. Then we have excess energy. The blocks get lifted up, put into the exact place because the software knows exactly where to put them. And we are storing energy this way. Then
I'm still so confused because that's how you build any building.
Right, but you got to keep in mind that
these are just stacked, so they could be taken apart again, and then you can get the energy out.
Right, there's no mortar here. Right, they're lowered onto each other, and then they have this swivel thing that kind of locks them in place. It's very quick and easy, so the building has some rigidity to it. But then when they want to pull energy out of this building, then the cranes will pick up the blocks and lower them. Now, imagine you have this heavy concrete block pulling down.
How heavy, Jay?
Yeah, that's a good question. Bob, 35 tons. These things are super, super heavy. And they pull – now listen. They pull the crane line down, and the crane – this is like the braking system in a car that reclaims energy from a moving vehicle. This exists today. So that force of pulling down the cable – creates energy inside the system that they have, where the cable will pull on the thing that will generate electricity. So the company has proprietary algorithms that are constantly optimizing the efficiency, and I'm sure that the software is going to get better as this thing gets built, and it's going to be built this year, by the way, the first one.
Oh, yeah?
This thing all day, there's extra energy, and the cranes are lifting up the concrete blocks that are on the ground, and it plops them into place, and they lock together. And then at night, when the sun goes away and we need to put some energy back into the grid, the crane will go over and it will pick up, there's 6 cranes. So there'll be, slowly disassembling the tower like row by row. And then as the blocks pull the crane line down, the crane lines create energy, right? So pulling the blocks up costs energy, right? That's where the electricity is going to run a motor that pulls the block up. And then when the block comes back down, it does the exact opposite. It runs an engine that creates electricity. So for example, a tower that has been fully charged, if you will, right, has been fully constructed with all that potential energy stored in it, could per hour supply 35,000 average homes with power.
All right. Big question. What's my big question? Jay? What's the efficiency?
90%. It's 90% efficient.
90%.
I need more than just that number, man. How is that 90%?
Doesn't this matter also how far this thing away is from those homes and other things it's trying to power?
Of course, Evan.
That is true of anything. But
yeah, that goes without saying.
The advantage of this, like, this is basically the same concept as pumped hydro. And we've talked about this before, like with the concrete train, same thing. The idea is you could build a tower anywhere, just a straight up tower.
You just wouldn't want to build this on like a seismically active.
Yeah, no, of course not. With 35 ton blocks
that are just like tenuously stacked together.
But you could put it next to the wind turbines or next to the power source.
Consider this though. This type of energy storage doesn't lose any energy. It doesn't slowly degrade over time like a battery.
Yeah.
It doesn't leak. The only thing that that can wear it out will be the weather, you know, regular wear and tear of back and forth. And they've estimated that it's 30 to 40 years worth of life per tower. And the most important thing, which none of you thought of, which I didn't until I fully did my research, since concrete production itself is bad for the environment, what they're going to do is they're going to be making their concrete blocks out of concrete debris. So they're going to be collecting concrete debris and pressing it into these blocks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So where's that 10% loss of efficiency?
I think that's the cranes.
Friction.
That's the crane movement. Friction? Yeah, friction. Yeah, okay. So it's mechanical loss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, 90% is really efficient.
That's really good.
Doesn't that sound too high, Steve? That sounds a little bit too high to me.
Well, but also here's a question. How freaking expensive is this? Because is it really worth it if it only lasts 40 years?
I don't know. I mean, you know, look at it like this. The novel thing here, other than the wonderfully simple idea, this is like that rock song that you always thought you knew and you finally hear it. You're like, of course. Oh, my God. It's such a good idea. It's so obvious when you see the video. Like, yes, it's simple. It's got a crane. And there is no technology in this crane that isn't already in existence. It's applying multiple things that have already been developed together. We already have the energy reclamation engine. We already know how those motors work. So it's really just the engineering and then the raw cost of constructing everything. I don't think it's going to be insanely expensive because the vast majority of this thing is concrete.
And Kara, compare it to a grid storage with this amount of storage out of lithium ion batteries, right?
Yeah.
Or anything else. What else, you know, how much would that cost? How long would it last? What would, you know, what's the efficiency? Those numbers are all sounding pretty good. We have to see if they really hold up in the real world. But
it's true. It's not going to be any more of an eyesore than all the windmills.
Well, that's true.
Right.
They're cool looking too.
Hopefully birds won't go flying into these things.
I think this is safer than a windmill, for birds at least.
Again, I love this because it's simple. We already, you know, the technology is already there. And it plays right into the grid. Like, it just works with the electric grid so well. Like, this is going – I really hope I see one of these soon somewhere around here.
Yeah. I mean, it may work for grid storage. Again, you have to see how the numbers work out in real life. But those numbers do sound good. All right. Evan, where are all the insects going?
Oh, boy. Isn't that a huge question with a horrid answer, unfortunately. You know, last month we had talked about the monarch butterfly decline or collapse, if you will, in Western America. But today, the news that's in the headlines from The Guardian reads that plummeting insect numbers globally threaten the collapse of nature altogether. You think they're being a little sensational with that headline?
Collapse of nature?
Yeah.
Sounds a little bit overhyped.
Yeah.
Sounds a little bit overhyped. There is reason at least to be, I think, concerned. Because this is being reported as the first global scientific review of the Earth's collective ecosystems. This review was authored by Francisco Sanchez Bayo at the University of Sydney in Australia and Chris Weichuks at the China Academy of Agricultural Sciences in Beijing. And the review appears in the online journal Biological Conservation. the authors reviewed 73 historical reports of insect declines from around the world that have occurred over the last 13 years. And here are the highlights of what they were able to collect in their review. Over 40% of insect species are threatened with extinction. The Lepidopteras, which are the butterflies and moths, yep. The Hymenopteras, which are the wasps and our bees and our ants, among others. And our beetle groups, our Coleopteras. These are the groups most effective. Four aquatic taxa are imperiled or have already lost a large portion of species. That habitat loss by conversion to intensive agriculture is the number one driver of these declines. And agrochemical pollutants, invasive species, and climate change are additional causes. So they did this review and they sort of put the causes in order. Suffice to say, the authors are concerned about the impact of insect decline because it affects everything. The whole food chain is affected by what's happening to our insects. You know, fish, birds, and reptiles depend on the insects as a primary food source. So you start taking away the food source for these animals, and they are destined to have this bleak future as well.
Well, insects are necessary for pollinating every plant, too, and dispersing seeds. And oh my, it's everything is connected to insects. Yeah.
Well, yeah, just to be clear, some plants are wind pollinated. Not every plant is insect pollinated.
You are correct. I shouldn't have said every. I meant that hyperbolically.
Yeah. But many.
The void that's going to be left by these insects going away are friendly insects. Other insects, which are less desirable, less useful to us, will take the place. They say cockroaches and horseflies, for example, will fill these voids. And it's not exactly the same thing. So they're saying, you know, the number of insects may not overall diminish, but the diversity of insects most certainly is decreasing and falling. And they estimate by about 2.5% a year, a decline of 2.5% per year on average.
But what is the cause? I mean, is there any real understanding of the cause and how we can stop it? Is it global warming? What is it?
Global warming is definitely a part of it. But they put it in order of main causes. So number one, habitat loss and conversion to intensive agriculture and urbanization. So basically, poor use of farmlands and sprawling farmlands that's taking away the natural habitats of the insects. The second cause is pollution and synthetic pesticides and fertilizers. Number three, biological factors, including pathogens and introduced species. And number four, climate change. Now, you'll get some scientists who have commented on this review. And mostly they're saying they're kind of agreeing with the overall notion here, but perhaps they're saying that the causes could be in a different order than this. In other words, climate change may actually be closer to the top of the list rather than the fourth on this list, for example. So those are the things that are being debated. And what we need to do is just much, much better job of protecting these natural environments, preservations for insects. You know, we think of we have a bias, I think, towards the larger land-based animals. We treat our insects not exactly the same way. We don't see them in the same light. It's kind of a human bias at work here, in which, you know, you don't hear many people, you know, complaining too much about this problem, whereas we'll be, you know, happy to take up the causes of polar bears and, you know, other things that are closer to our size, perhaps.
Yeah, E.O. Wilson has long talked about that, right? We just like beetles, for example, or ants. Those are two big ones that he often talks about, that they are so fundamental, but we just don't notice them. That's the real problem. And they're not charismatic in the sense that like large mammals are. But that's not to say that, you know, taking up the cause for a polar bear or a rhinoceros is a bad thing, because ultimately they do all affect one another. I think people who are more mindful of extinction are going to be more mindful of it across the board.
Yeah, unfortunately. It's just hard. You know, we're just using so much of the landmass of the earth, you know, for cities and food growing. And, you know, just our industries are having a massive impact. We just have to really start paying attention to having a smaller footprint and to, you know, getting things done more efficiently, et cetera. But there's no way around the fact that we're not getting out of, you know, this time in history without a major sixth extinction. We're just thinking now about ways to minimize it. But all right, let's move on. Bob, you're going to finish up by telling us about building space stations inside asteroids. Why would we do that?
If you insist.
Because it's cool as hell. How about that?
So yeah, this one was cool. So a new study examines the feasibility of a space station, not in Earth orbit, not by the moon or Mars, but as Steve explicitly said, inside an asteroid. The goal of the space station is not scientific observation or even storage of quadratriticale, but asteroid mining. So yeah, this is the most exciting space engineering project that I've heard of in quite a while. Just so many nice little juicy bits. So the new study is from the University of Vienna astrophysicists, who used gravity models of a virtual asteroid measuring 500 meters by 390 meters. So now asteroid mining's been getting more and more attention in the past decade. If you've been paying attention to this, it's definitely been ramping up. And this is primarily or significantly because of the increasing realization that there's a shit ton of booty out there. Say, Jay.
What? Booty.
So seriously, though, there is so much money out there. It's insane. For example, NASA estimated in 2016 that the minerals out there could essentially be worth $100 billion for every person.
Yeah, until you flood the market, then it's not.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, but that's good, a whole point. Other thing. Good point. Yeah. that's a totally different beast. But just to give you an example of what's out there or what they
quantity.
Think is out there.
Right.
Goldman Sachs thinks, for example, that the world's first true trillionaire will be a space miner. another reason for any sense of urgency, though, is this one was a little bit surprising, is the potential depletion of key elements needed for today's modern civilization. Now, some elements or some people think that elements like very important ones like tin, phosphorus, silver, and copper, and more could be, for all intents and purposes, gone within half a century. I didn't explicitly vet that statement outside of the context of this, but that thought is out there, and we could be seeing some serious depletions in, you know, within that time. Seems reasonable. So there's something like 12,000 asteroids within 45 million kilometers of our planet. It's a lot of asteroids out there, and many of them could be filled with iron ore and nickel and precious metals. And the thing is, a lot of geologists think that the concentrations of these precious minerals could be much higher than we have on Earth. So you can imagine these mountains of iron ore and even or silver and gold that are out there, and some have even been
silver
identified.
And gold.
Now, a Caltech report looked at the potential costs of some potential space mining technology, which is an interesting way to look at this because, you know, it doesn't really need that much of a futuristic, you know, technology to pull some of this stuff off. You know, it's not like we're talking about Star Trek level tech. For example, they reported that a simple prospecting probe could be built for perhaps $20 to $40 million each. And I assume that's a USD. Now, a much more ambitious thing, like, for example, an asteroid towing spacecraft, something that could potentially bring one into the inner solar system, would cost $2.6 billion. And sure, that seems like a lot of money. But when you're talking about an asteroid that could be worth many trillions of dollars, do the math. I mean, do pirates care about the cost of cannonballs when they're attacking a galleon loaded with gold bullion? I don't think so. I think that's a decent comparison. It's like, oh boy, don't waste those cannonballs. So of course, sending ore back home to the Earth is not the only benefit. I mean, obviously, you've got these invaluable resources right there on an asteroid that you're mining. They could be used to refuel or even build space missions destined to go far, far beyond the asteroid itself, wherever that asteroid may be. Yeah.
Should we ever worry about bringing too much material down to the surface of the Earth?
At any one time, yes. Absolutely. I mean, if we take an asteroid that's got, you know, a million tons of gold, and we put it in a parking orbit around the Earth, yeah, you could absolutely do huge damage to the gold market or any other market. So yeah, that's definitely something that could happen. But hey, you know,
what about consequences to like the actual weight of the Earth itself?
No, God no, God no. Who you know? So what? Bring 10 Mount Everests worth of resources down from many, many asteroids. So what? I mean, what the hell?
Compared to the overall mass of the
right,
Earth?
Right, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
What about like pollutants, though, or things like that, you know? I mean, well, I guess it's better than mining here.
Yeah, true. I mean, if you're doing this mining in space, clearly that's going to probably be better than mm-hmm. but depending on the technology as well. For me, mm-hmm. one of the scariest things about this, if you actually want to bring tow an asteroid and put it into Earth orbit, say fairly close, that is a potential weapon that's you could devastate. The mm-hmm. entire Earth. You make one mistake, or if you're malicious about it, I think I'll take out the Earth. I'll put this in an orbit that intersects the Earth. Not good. But I digress. But the problem, though, so that's the background. The problem that these astrophysicists were primarily dealing with isn't necessarily a hugely obvious one, and namely, that's gravity or the lack thereof.
Mm.
These asteroids are massive as hell, but there's not a lot of, we're not talking about a lot of gravity here. So conventional mining equipment that is designed to work in the deep gravity well of Earth, of course, but they won't work well in the microgravity on an asteroid. I mean, you just have to, just push against the surface of the asteroid that you're working on or you're mining, and you could launch yourself into space. There's plenty of bodies in our solar system that if you took a nice jump, you would go into orbit or exceed escape velocity potentially. So there's that. Then, of course, the negative effects of low or no gravity on humans is legendary, right? We all know that astronauts come back from the space station, depleted bone loss, your muscular atrophy. And if you're there for extended periods of time, say if you're mining out in space for a year, 6 months, whatever, I mean, not only is there severe bone loss, there's immune depression, there's blood pressure issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of nasty stuff. So those are problems. So we got to start thinking then, well, how could we alleviate that? An artificial gravity generation is certainly something you want to consider. Now, I'm not talking sci-fi gravity plating like on Star Trek and a host of lots of other sci-fi scenarios. That's just basically not going to happen, period. You can quote me on that. Now, rotational gravity, though, is doable, right? Instead of building a rotating space station that's very popular in science fiction, what about using the centripetal acceleration of a rotating asteroid? So now the space station then could be inside the asteroid. Imagine that. You've got, you would basically just dig into it and build the space station inside it. And the mining can happen from the inside out instead of the outside in. And this is exactly what this paper is proposing. They found that if an asteroid was made of enough solid stone, say, mm-hmm. it would have to be very rigid, very solid stone, and like I said, 500 meters by 390 meters, spinning 1 to 3 times a minute, then that, they say, would create a pseudo-gravity approximately, what do you think? What do you think that would be, guys? What percentage of Earth's gravity would that be?
0.2.
No idea.
0.2? No, that's not bad. 0.5. That's not bad. 38% of Earth's which is actually very similar to Mars. So that they figured 38% was good enough so that the majority of the problems that you would encounter in microgravity would be alleviated by having just enough where it wouldn't be so debilitating. So here's a cool quote from the paper, guys. So the novelty in our approach is to investigate whether the asteroidal hull, once set to rotation as a whole, can sustain the material loads resulting from a sufficiently high rotation weight. So that's what they did that no one's really done before. It's like, what kind of forces are you going to generate on an asteroid that's spinning 1 to 3 times per minute? Because this thing could break apart. This thing goes a little too fast, it's going to break apart. What kind of structures, what kind of rock do you need that will actually hold its shape? Especially, now imagine you're inside this asteroid and you're digging it out. You're taking stuff iron away. You're taking stuff away from it. It would have to be something, some sort of a silicate rock or something that's got a really good rigidity, really strong stuff, very solid. It can't be, a lot of asteroids, they think, or some of them could be these, basically loosely gravitationally bound rubble, piles of rubble. And I'm sure they're going to find some there. That's obviously not a good candidate. So the lead author of the study, Dr. Thomas Mandel, said, if we find an asteroid that's stable enough, we might not need these aluminum walls or anything. You might just be able to use the entire asteroid as a space station. So that's the other really cool option. If this thing is really rock solid, so to speak, I mean, you would need minimal walls at all for the space station. Just dig a good hole, widen it up a bit, seal it off, and take whatever precautions you need there. Of course, we have to be careful, though, because, there's the inevitable consequence of, you're creating an oppressed working class, and then they form the Outer Planet Alliance, and, well, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself, and I'm watching too much Expanse. But, yeah, so this was really cool. Guys, what do you think? Would you Do you think we're going to see this thing in within the next half century, or is it going to take something like 75 to 100 years or more before we see something like this?
Yeah, it'd probably be closer to 100 years. Yeah.
Out there, yeah.
It's too bad because, it depends on the pressure, though. We talk about, selective evolutionary pressure here. You know, if we really start running out of resources, like imagine if we run out of silver or tin or phosphorus, I think that could really, light a fire under a lot of people's butts and really try to accelerate this, because it's really not that, the technology is not that crazy. It's just you just got to get out there and do it and build up some experience and see, what are the unknowns. And I'm hoping we could see that before a century passes. But I don't know. The money is just so insane that I think it's going to really be a driver here.
Yeah, it might be the next gold rush. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Yeah, that's a big ROI.
All right, cool. Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. So, guys, what is that?
It sounded like bees, Jay.
It sounded like a vacuum cleaner almost.
It definitely sounded like weather.
Yep.
Like wind and rain.
There's definitely like a almost a white noise aspect to this, right? Mm-hmm. There's like that super heavy repetitive thing going on. So we got some cool guesses here this week. All right, so this is a hard name to pronounce. I think it's Kjetil, Kjetil. So this listener wrote, the Who's That Noisy in episode 709 sounds like some massive insect swarm, maybe out of a forest. I think I can hear other foresty ambient sound too. Just a wild guess. And thank you for putting out another great show. Nope, that's not it. Hold your horses though, because that isn't such a bad guess. Let's keep going real quick. This listener said, hi, is the noisy the sound of a beehive during a warm summer night? More insects. I thought that was pretty cool. That listener's name was Wrong Fang L.I. And then we had a winner from last week. This is Bruce Bridwell, and Bruce said, it sounds like summertime in Florida, cicadas and frogs. But I'm an alien, so what the hell do I know? Love what you guys are doing. Best regards. Bruce won because Bruce was the first one to mention frogs. But I do believe that there are some insect noises mixed in with this. So this was sent in by a listener named Jack Davidson. Jack's father lives in the Bolivian Amazon. And this was a recording that his father got for him. And Jack and I were emailing each other, and he asked his dad, what breed of frog was that? And his dad said, there's so many types of frogs out there, it's impossible to pin down one. So the bottom line is, it's thousands of breeds of frogs. And I guarantee you there's insect noise mixed in with there, but it's largely frogs.
Something from a Hitchcock movie, almost.
Yeah, definitely. It is kind of creepy.
Sounds like the Amazon at night.
Yeah, you would know.
It's cool. Yeah. I have so many noises I need to give you.
Yeah, I'm still waiting. What the hell, boy? Yeah. What the hell? So, great guess, Bruce, and thank you, Jack, for that one. That was pretty cool. So, I got a new noisy this week. All right, to speak proper English, I have a new noisy this week. This listener's name is Oyvind from Norway. And the listener said that they've emailed me before, they've guessed before, and probably submitted before, but they did send in this noisy. I really like it, so check this out. Oh, God. If a noisy can make me laugh and make me, have to think about what the hell is it, it's perfect.
Yeah, right. That's Jay's sweet spot.
So thank you very much for sending that noisy in. If you think you know what the noisy is this week, or if you heard anything cool at all this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Okay, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for the news items this week?
Yes, yes we are.
Yes, I am.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that the single most effective way to preserve wild fish populations is to promote aquaculture, or, in other words, fish farming. Item number two. For the first time, a fish has passed the mirror test used as a marker for self-awareness in animals. And item number three, an economic analysis reveals that investment in Lego sets yields stable annual returns exceeding precious stones and metals and rare coins, with the best investments yielding up to 600% annual return. Jay, go first.
So a new study finds that the single most effective way to preserve wild fish populations is to promote aquaculture, fish farming. Okay, so that does make sense on its surface. The fish farming could saturate the market and then maybe have an effect on the people that are fishing the ocean. So that makes sense. I also like this idea of promoting aquaculture. Like, you know, what they'll end up doing is they'll show fish like movies, you know, like SpongeBob TV shows and stuff like that. And they'll be like they're on dates and they'll have more fish sex. And that there you go. So it's a doubleheader. It's a great one, Steve. So I think that one's science. The second one here, for the first time, a fish has passed the mirror test used as a marker for self-awareness in animals. Whoa. Now, that's a big one. That mirror test, boy, we hold that in high regard, right? Okay. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. The fish passed the mirror test, meaning that it had some type of self-awareness. And I remember other animals that have passed that test, elephant and chimps. A fish, huh? We don't really think fish think that much. Does it matter what kind of fish, Steve?
Not particularly.
It's just a fish. Okay. All right, let me read the third one here. An economic analysis reveals that investment in Lego sets yields stable annual returns exceeding precious stones and metals and rare coins, with the best investments yielding a 600% annual return. So you're saying that some Legos will have a 600% annual return?
That's what it says.
All right. Well, I have a son that is obsessed with Legos, and they are very expensive. And if you go on eBay, they apparently do not lose any value whatsoever. But I'm not really, unless it's a Lego set that you can't get anymore, I don't see them going up in price. So I'm going to say this one is the fake.
Okay, Kara.
I don't know. I feel like Lego sets, if they're still in the box, if they haven't been touched and they're like vintage, Legos have been around a long time. Or is it Lego has been around? Aren't you not supposed to pluralize it?
Yeah, you can say Lego.
Yeah, Lego has been around a long time. And I wouldn't be surprised if old Lego sets are worth 600 times what they were when you first bought them. I mean, they weren't worth as much back then. Now they're pretty expensive off the shelf. But I'm sure, you know, 30 years ago when you bought a Lego set, it cost $3. I can
probably
see it being worth
six times, not 600, right?
Yeah, six times. Yeah. Even if it were 600, I wouldn't be surprised if it were like one very, very rare one. So I don't know. I think collections can pay off, but the market always shifts. So, you know, different things are in vogue at different times, and
yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Kara, should I point out that it's 600% per year?
That's the best investment.
Yeah.
So it's saying overall, they exceed precious stones and metals and rare coins, but the best investments can be that high. So that is going to be like in the long tail anyway. That's going to be an outlier. So I'm not concerned about that. You could put any rando number and I'd be like, yeah, there's going to be one that's an outlier. But the stable annual return, so every year exceeding precious stones and metals and rare coins, is that exceeding every single precious stone and metal? There's not a single precious stone or metal that exceeds it, or on average?
That's the way I think that's on average.
Yeah, it would probably be on average. So yeah, this one seems reasonable to me. The study that finds, the single most effective way to preserve wild fish populations is to promote aquaculture. This one is probably a lot more complicated than it seems on its surface. I've done a lot of research into aquaculture. I've covered it a lot. I think it's a good way to maintain viable food sources, but I'm not sure if it necessarily is going to help preserve wild fish populations.
So you do know about this. I mean, do they show the movies or not?
They don't think they show the movies often. There may be some cool lab experiments where they're doing that though, Jay. So keep your hopes up. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a screen with SpongeBob in some aquaculture labs. But yeah, that one to me seems like it could be the fiction. I mean, the fish passing the mirror test seems like it could be the fiction too, but you know how it is. I feel like it's going to be the one that I least expect in this case. And that would be between aquaculture and, the more obvious one would be the fish and the less obvious one would be aquaculture. So I think I'm going to screw myself over and go with the less obvious one and say the aquaculture is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I happen to agree with a lot that Kara said. Not to denigrate Jay's eBay, his mad eBay skills.
Oh crap! I forgot about that.
But I don't necessarily think though that Jay is tracking lots of these the big Lego sets and yeah, you make a good point that Outlier and all that stuff. But sure, there I think there could be some, and I don't know how they do in terms of. Once they put out a set, do they like, okay, we're going to sell this for a year and then that's it. It's not available anymore. I don't even know if they do that. But let me jump to the fish one, the mirror test. Yeah, that one just like my knee jerk is like, no way. It's just too strong. It's just like too obvious. So I'm going to do that little meta playing here for that one. So I'm going to go with Kara on the aquaculture. Yeah, I think. You say the way you say it, Steve, is the most effective way to preserve wild fish populations. I think with a few well-placed laws, you could probably have a greater impact on wild fish populations than having to build and support a whole like an industry of aquaculture. So I'll say that's fiction.
And Evan,
yeah, the first, how do they even measure the fish has passed the mirror test? That's remarkable.
By giving it the mirror test.
Yeah, I understand that, but, you know.
I know, I've never for chimps.
I mean, here's the thing, though.
They put a mark on them.
This isn't the first time that they've ever given the fish the mirror test, but suddenly the first time that it's passed the mirror test, something's a little off there. But what's more off, I think, is the one that Kara and Bob are leaning towards. I'm going to lean towards that one as well as being the single most effective way to preserve wild fish. I think that's the key. I don't think. It's too definitive there. There's probably something more effective, or there are several things which seem to be equally effective, I would say, not just the single most effective. As far as Lego sets go, when you're comparing it to things like precious stones, metals, and rare coins, yeah, I don't think those things, you get great returns on those. I don't know anyone who's got a ton of that stuff in their portfolio and that they're doing much better than, say, stock market. Or other things. And as far as the best investments yielding the 600% annual return, sure, if you got something super rare there among the Lego stuff, I could see that being possible. So yeah, I'll go with Bob and Kara.
Okay, so we have Jay on his own for the Legos and everyone else for the fish farming. So that means you all agree.
Doesn't look good for me, Steve.
You think so? You all agree on number two. For the first time, a fish has passed the mirror test used as a marker for self-awareness. You all think that one is science. And that one is science.
Mm.
How many other people saw that one?
I did.
No, I didn't.
Me too.
I didn't.
Yeah. Sorry, you know, Steve. It's hard to tell when I'm making this up. Sometimes, like, later in the day, it comes out.
And it's hard for me to lie, so... Sorry, if that influenced anybody.
You avoid it.
But if you hadn't read it, that would have been tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's bananas that a fish would pass the mirror test. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Is.
A dog can't pass the mirror
test. It's crazy.
Test.
It's crazy time. So,
I think it was an uplifted fish.
The mirror test is where you put a mark on an animal that, or something on them that they should be able to respond to. In this case, the fish cleans itself. So if it sees anything on itself, it will clean stuff off of itself. And then...
How? Does it just like bang its face against the glass? It doesn't have hands.
It may rub up against something.
Okay, so first of all, the name of the fish...
Frankie Fish Fish.
McFish Fish.
Fishy McFish Face. It is the... the Blue Streak Cleaner Wrasse. WRASSE, RASS.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small fish with the length of a human finger, swims in the shallow reefs of the Indo-Pacific. So they nibble dead skin, mucus, and parasites off other fish. That's why it's the cleaner fish. So they put a black mark on this fish, and when it looked in the mirror, it took steps to clean the mark off itself. So it indicated knowledge that what was in the mirror was itself. That's the idea of the mirror test. And that is supposed to be a marker for self-awareness. We've spoken about this before. So fish aren't supposed to have the cerebral cortex, the awareness, to pass the mirror test. And so it was very surprising that it did. So surprising, in fact, that you could interpret this as calling the mirror test itself into question.
Nice.
As a marker for self-awareness. Because they're saying, well, okay, so maybe this fish, something is going on in its head that it's able to pass this test, but it's still not self-aware, like a primate is. And so we have to rethink what neurologically, what processes could lead to the ability to pass the test. But it unequivocally passed the test. There's no question.
And didn't we notice that there's like new mirror tests for animals that don't pass it because that's just not how they perceive? Like dogs have like a smell mirror test now that they pass no problem. They just don't pass the visual mirror test.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like we got to completely rethink the paradigm.
So the fish attempted to scrape it off on surrounding surfaces. So it was rubbing up against stuff to get it off.
No.
So probably thought it was a parasite.
Oh.
Yeah,
now it's a traumatized fish. Great.
Yeah, but that's okay because we don't think fish are cute and we can flush them down the toilet, no problem.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just like the
Charlie.
Unlike those robots.
Unlike those cute robots. Can't flush them.
So the fish is engaging in new behaviors linked to the spot. Like it wasn't something that it typically does. So it's really hard to have a false positive here.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, but it does tell whenever you're trying to infer what's going on inside an animal's head based on some behavior, you got to be careful. And we come up with these paradigms, of how to do that, and then something breaks them,
Like the fish might just be sensitive to whatever they use to mark it. Like it might not have actually seen it in the mirror.
Well, but you have to have a fish. You have to have a fish with the mark, not with a mirror, as a control. Yeah.
Did they do that, or did they only put a fish?
I hope so. I'm trying to
I would think so, too.
Right.
But they might have just made the control a fish that doesn't have the mark in front of a mirror.
Yeah. So one of them said that the fish could have been saying to the fish in the mirror, hey, you got something right here. Guy, dude, right here. You got to clean that off.
The other side.
So they have to, that's why you have to look at this in multiple different ways to make sure it all lines up. You know what I mean? You have to try to control for confounding factors any way you can. Right.
Gosh.
All right. Okay, let's go back to number one. A new study finds that the most effective way to preserve wild fish populations is to promote aquaculture or fish farming. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction. Sorry, Jay.
Oh, I read that wrong.
Yes, you did. Yay.
It's the fiction. You guys are correct. I'm sensing a theme here that whichever one of you goes first gets it wrong, the other three get it correct. That's been going on for a while.
Weird.
So there actually was a study which showed that aquaculture does little, if anything. It basically did nothing in the study to promote wild fish populations.
Oh, no.
In fact, so the idea is, as Jay said, you grow a lot of fish in aquaculture. You don't have to do as much farming. You're filling the market with that. With the aquaculture fish. That's the idea, right? To save wild fish populations. But they said it just didn't have any effect. It just grows the market. And in fact, it may create a market for that fish and actually increase fishing, paradoxically.
Mm. Also, there are people who are like, when I did it was a GMO salmon story for Al Jazeera back in the day. I went to Seattle, right, where Pike Place, like fish markets are huge in Seattle. It's a big area for that. And I also went to Alaska and I interviewed people in fish markets. Like, do you prefer farmed or wild caught? And like nobody wanted farmed fish. Like there's a stigma around farmed fish the same way there's an anti-GMO stigma.
Hmm.
People who want to buy wild fish are going to buy it because it's wild caught.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate.
Yeah. That is unfortunate. Okay, all of this means that an economic analysis reveals that investment in Lego sets yield stable annual returns exceeding precious stones and metals and rare coins, with the best investments yielding 600% annual return. That is science. This was surprising. And it's not just the occasional rare collector. So they said on average, an unopened set of Lego, right? Unopened sets yielded a profit of 11% per year. So 11% per year is a pretty good investment. If you think about it, like if I make 11% on my mutual fund, I'm happy.
Yeah, right? Isn't the average 9%?
And it wasn't very volatile. Yeah. It wasn't
so, Steve,
very
why aren't we all running out buying Legos then? Like,
hang on, we should be. And
we're about to be.
You could break it down. At the sets that were consisted up to 350 pieces were the best. That they averaged 22%. That's 22% per year on average. And then followed by the bigger sets, the 1,200 to 6,000 pieces, those yielded a 12% annual profit. So that's across the board. That's pretty damn good if you think about it, like any investment making that, you know, pretty reliably. That's a pretty good, you know, return. But the ones it was the sort of specialty sets, the seasonal sets that had the best profit. So the idea sets averaged 64%. 64% for the just picking any idea set. But the number one, what do you think was the number one?
The Millennium Falcon.
You're very close, Jay. Darth Raven from the Star Wars series.
Darth Raven.
Yielded an average annual profit of 613%.
Whoa.
Followed by the Elves Workshop from seasonal series with a profit of 590%.
So are these limited release versions? There was a Star versions?
I have those Lego sets that are like the Women in Science Lego sets. Yeah. Remember when they released those? And yep. They're still in the box. I think I have two different ones. There's a Women in Science, and then there's a Women of NASA. So
that's
maybe in like 20 years.
Good investment. These were all released in 2014, not that long ago.
Oh, wow.
So if you bought these things 5 years ago, you know, let's say you bought $10,000 worth of Lego Star Wars sets, I mean, that would be worth, you know, a couple of $100,000 now.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but how, I mean, is it hard to sell that crap?
Yeah, what exactly is the market?
I don't think so. You just sell them on eBay.
Yeah.
And they must be discontinued because otherwise, why wouldn't you just go out and buy it at fair market value?
That's the thing. The Women in Science set and the Women in NASA set were both not just short run, like limited edition, they sold out.
Yeah. Mm.
And so people were trying to get their hands on them. I think they might have even re-released and then sold out again, one of them. So even now, I bet you they're worth more money. Now I'm going to look them up on
eBay. Still got my Cabbage Patch Kids. I wonder how they're going up in print.
You do?
Gosh, no.
Oh. It's like, whoa.
That's more of a fad, really. I wonder if this is...
Yeah, that's the thing. If it's a fad, they could lose all their value if the market collapses. But the point of this study was that Legos are a pretty stable holder of value because they've been around for so long, they're really not going anywhere. It's interesting to think about toys as an investment.
Yeah. I mean, we have plenty here, but they're not in the box. You know,
these are unopened sets. These are all unopened sets.
Yeah. Women in Science is only worth $55 right now. I wonder what it was new, but some people are buying it up to $150. Interesting. We gotta wait.
It's quite a franchise. We just saw the Lego Movie 2.
I heard it was very good.
This weekend. It was good. That's right.
Oh, God.
It's enjoyable.
You're kidding me.
It was okay.
We took our kids, but
yeah,
I probably wouldn't have gone if we weren't going with kids. But, you know, for a kids movie, it's very cute. It's very clever. Lots of, you know, lots of humor. And talk about, you know, winding back to our first news item. You have no problem perceiving emotion in these plastic toys. No problem.
Yeah, not even a little problem. It's like just they're people. That's it.
They are people. They act with agency and they have effective affect display and they show emotion. That's it. They're people.
Lego rights now.
Absolutely.
Lego lawyers. The whole thing's on the way. Yeah.
So, what did you guys think of the newsletter?
It was a wonderful surprise. All of a sudden, boom, newsletter. Cool.
I know. Well, we've been working on it for a while. I mean, it really came out, I hate to say it came out better than I thought, but I was always worried. You know, it's the first one, the very, very first one that we ever did. And I'm really happy with it. I got a ton of awesome, positive email. I'd like to thank everyone for that. And I wrote a note to everyone at the end of it, just thanking, you know, the listeners and our patrons for making it possible. And it's coming out the first week of every month. And the newsletter is just a quick review of some of our better bits of the month. And then also some fun and interesting things that me and everybody else has found online during the month that never got aired or we never discussed or whatever. There's a lot of stuff that we come across.
How do people sign up for this newsletter?
That's a good question, Steve. If you want to sign up for the newsletter, you can go to theskepticsguide.org and you'll see a place to sign up in the you know, mostly upper right-hand corner. You'll see it there. And please do.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing everybody this weekend at the AAAS.
Yeah.
Me too, man.
Can't wait.
That'll be our next episode. It'll be our live show from the AAAS. So keep an eye out for that. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.